Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New Yorker magazine editor-in-chief David Remnick is only the fifth editor to steer his venerable institution in its 81 years of posh ads and prized prose. But he cut his teeth as a reporter, and he's still at it, sizing up the likes of Larry Holmes and Mike Tyson, Al Gore and Don DeLillo, Katharine Graham and Vladimir Putin. He's out with a new collection of profiles of the great and once great, and out every week with a magazine that can seem at war with the Bush administration. This hour On Point, we talk with David Remnick on reporting and running The New Yorker. You can join the conversation. Are you glad for an editor who climbs out of his ivory tower and writes? What's your up-close question for the man who has nailed Netanyahu and Sharansky, Philip Roth and Solzhenitsyn, the man who watched Mike Tyson nearly eat Evander Holyfield's ear off? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is David Remnick. He's out with a new collection of profiles entitled Reporting, Writings from The New Yorker. He's been editor-in-chief since 98, with the magazine since 1992. Before that, he was Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post in the last years of the Soviet Union. His book, Lenin's Tomb, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1994. Articles by David Remnick, says The New York Times, can stand as literature. David Remnick, welcome to On Point. Good to have you.
It's great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here you are, out of the editor's chair and out in the field again and again and again. How do you do both? How do you run a great big magazine like this with a weekly deadline and find yourself on the West Bank and in Moscow and all over the place?
Well, I'm very bad at the beach. I don't do the beach very well. And
that leaves you some extra time.
And it's absolutely true. You mentioned the ivory tower. I think for me, I'm not saying it's the case for any other editor. For me, it's good for me, and I think the magazine, a couple of times a year, to get the hell out of the office and get into the world a little bit. Otherwise, I would live a life of Manhattan apartment, subway, the office, reading the obvious half a dozen newspapers, blogs. And for me, again, it might be totally different for another editor and certainly has been in the past. It would not be great. And so this is a way for me to get out a bit, maybe contribute to the magazine. And since I'm in the business sometimes of criticizing writing, maybe to see how hard it is all over again.
I wonder about that, how your writers like it. I read one of them saying, you know, this is too much. He comes back. He writes so easily. He writes so quickly. It's like having Bob Gibson in his prime as your pitching coach. It's just unbelievable to have David Remnick writing and editing. What do your reporters, do they like it, your writers, that you're out in the field as well?
Well, I think in terms of time, it's really not much of a factor. As I say, I don't go on long trips to this beach or that. I'm not very good at that. I try to spend plenty of time with my family, but I'm not great at standard issue vacation. I think the business of editing is so complete. It's a weekly magazine. It's coming at you all the time. And writers need your presence and your support and your sympathy, that if that collapsed, if they didn't have that, that they would be rightly furious with me. The business of an editor, though, writing is not unprecedented. It's just a little different for The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Michael Kinsley, who edited Harper's and The New Republic, wrote all the time.
Sure.
Rick Hertzberg, when he was editing The New Republic, Lewis Lapham at Harper's. Mm-hmm. And if you go way back, Cyril Connolly with Horizon. I mean, it's not that unusual. It's just a little different for The New Yorker. And I think by now it's been 7-8 years, so I think most people are used to it.
You've done all kinds of reporting. The Washington Post had you on many fronts. You write with a kind of a charming modesty that when you were sent to Moscow, it was made clear to you that you were the number two man at the bureau. You've written up Revolution and all the rest. Now, profiles really draw you. That's really everything in this book, and clearly it's most of what you do when you go out. Why profiles? Why go deep on one person each time?
Well, the book that I did, first book I did about Russia and the collapse of the Soviet Union, Lenin's Tomb, was marinated fruit. and the marination.
You'd been there, you'd watched.
Right. I was there for 4 years, and I watched and watched, and I learned a language pretty well and got to know a lot of people quite deeply, and was in a position to write a kind of journalistic narrative of this historical event. I'm not living in Bolivia or Tehran or any of these places. And so you choose a form that you can do while essentially parachuting as a reporter. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Parachuting means arriving at a place or with a person and staying there for a finite period of time.
Into one living room, one kitchen, one castle in Vaclav Havel's case.
Exactly. And there has to be some element of modesty to the project. You may have read, as I try to do, a half a dozen books on any subject or more, as in Solzhenitsyn's case. But you're catching a person in time. You're not writing a mini biography, which would be very boring. Mm-hmm. Read like an Encyclopedia Britannica entry. You're trying to see and hear that person in a finite period of time and make a story of it.
You quote Nabokov saying, in art as in science, there is no delight without the detail. You've got some greats and some once greats here. We're going to hear you read about some of them, but take us into a few of these. Just the moment, the detail that caught you. I particularly loved when you wrote about Vladimir Putin and President Bush's comment that he had looked into Putin's eyes and seen his soul. You described that as having been uproariously funny to an awful lot of Russians. Why?
Why? Because Putin really does look like a standard issue state security colonel, which is exactly what he was. And so the idea for
And those eyes? Can you see deeply into them?
They're very cold.
And flat. And without that depth.
And that's a practiced thing for a guy like Vladimir Vladimirovich. And so the idea that the American president shows up and they meet for a few hours and he's reckoned the soul of Putin was caused gales of laughter among Russians I knew. And for good reason.
David Remnick is with me. He's editor-in-chief of The New Yorker magazine. He's written a new collection, out with a new collection of profiles that he's written. But it started humbly. I wish you'd read for us a little bit, David, from right off the top of the book when you describe, I mean, you're really right up at the pinnacle now of what people get to do and write about in journalism. But it started,
it starts typically with the night police beat at The Washington Post. My first regular reporting job was on the night police beat in Washington, writing anonymous squibs about the catastrophes of others. A typical start, in other words. On my first night, the shift began at 6 and ended at 2 or 3 in the morning. I drove to D.C. police headquarters on Indiana Avenue to check out the so-called press room. With visions of cigar smoke, poker games, snapping typewriters, and some William Powell, Myrna Loy-type reporters making wised-up remarks about the desk, swirling unaccountably in my mind. I found the right door, opened it, and switched on the light. The bare fluorescent tubes overhead flickered, then buzzed into being. There were a couple of gray metal desks shoved into a corner, and on one of them, a heavy-set man still wearing a hat was fast asleep, wheezing a shrill fugue from under his pea-green raincoat. Finally, stirred by the light, he rose to his feet, squinted at me, and then fumbled around for a while in a shopping bag. He retrieved two cans and shoved them in his pockets. "Hello," he said, stepping smartly across the linoleum. "I'm the night guy for the Washington Times. You must be the latest postie." He reached into his jacket and pulled out a Schlitz. "Want a beer?" And so I began my time in the employ of Catherine Graham, Benjamin C. Bradley, and the Washington Post Company.
David Remnick reading from his new collection of profiles. It is called Reporting, Writings from the New Yorker. Of course, he edits the magazine. Take us into some of those Nabokovian details. Catherine Graham, you've got this great line. She was the queen mother with a lockjaw voice that sounded to us like money.
Well, sure. I mean, look, I was a young reporter who showed up at the Washington Post not 2 months after the biggest disaster, not the great Watergate triumph, I was too young for that, but their great disaster, the Janet Cook plagiarism disaster, which they had the terrible fortune of winning the Pulitzer Prize for and then had to give back, which was their kind of Jason Blair moment for the Post. And so Catherine Graham, for a young reporter, was a kind of mythological figure on a different floor. And the rare times that you'd see her, she had this incredible voice and syntax that, unless you were born to
a particular
society, that you had never heard before. And her voice sounded like money, as Fitzgerald would say. And you didn't know anything about her. She was kind of a source of humor. She was the grandee. And yet, when you got to know anything about her, you realized that she had established at the paper a set of ethical parameters and a tradition of doing the right thing and stepping up and publishing the Pentagon Papers and supporting Watergate reporting when it was being roundly criticized, not just by the government, by the rest of the press. And that meant the world to the Washington Post, every bit as much as Ben Bradley's behavior or Woodward and Bernstein.
I watched Katharine Graham as she'd go out into the world and be hosted by Washington Post correspondents here and there. They'd be absolutely beside themselves with nervousness that they could make or break their career in her presence. And you've seen
I
that
was
as
one
well.
Of them, sure.
She made presidents and kings feel the same way. Now you're editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, no mean seat. Does any editor have that kind of sway anymore? Not that many years after Katharine Graham.
Remember, she wasn't an editor. She was an owner.
Owner, publisher, you name it.
There's a big difference.
Sure.
Who
is it? Rupert Murdoch? Is that the equivalent?
I don't think Rupert Murdoch does journalistic endeavors like that. Rupert Murdoch is much more of a mogul and an accumulator and a business person.
Is there any news media figure, editor or publisher, who brings great names to heel in quite that way?
Well, the press is a very different picture now, isn't it? In all due respect to Abe Rosenthal and Ben Bradley of the Times and the Post, those places don't have quite the same primacy that they did in the 60s and the 70s. They just don't. And there's a reason for that, of the profusion of other media, the drop in circulation, the younger people reading those papers less. And so I think their authority is more in question.
David Remnick is with us. He's editor-in-chief of The New Yorker magazine. He's out with a new collection of profiles called Reporting. You can join us. Are you glad for an editor out of the ivory tower, out in the world? Are you a New Yorker reader? What does this magazine do for you, mean to you? Have you seen it change under Remnick? We're at 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New Yorker magazine editor and writer David Remnick about going deep with everyone from Solzhenitsyn to Mike Tyson. His new collection of profiles is Reporting, writings from The New Yorker, a year's worth of really terrific profiles there. You can join our conversation. What's your up-close and personal question for the man who's had eggs with Al Gore in the wilderness, sparred with Vladimir Putin, watched Mike Tyson eat Evander Holyfield's ear? Were you with Remnick when he said yes in his pages to war with Iraq? Are you with him now when his New Yorker's commentary and reporting attack Bush and the war effort from every angle? And in an age of blogs and print media, whoa, will this kind of publication, The New Yorker, last? What's your question for David Remnick? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Among the many you sat down with during this time was Al Gore. You called it his wilderness campaign he was in the midst of. Where and how did you find him? What was the Al Gore persona that you met, David Remnick?
Well, I caught Al Gore around the time of the last Democratic convention when he was coming out of his shell. He had experienced something that only a few people in American history have experienced, which is winning the popular vote and losing the election. I'll put giant quotes around the losing, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And what must this experience be like is very hard to imagine. And so I didn't want to imagine it. I wanted to hear about it from Al Gore. And finally, he was ready to talk. Remember, he had kind of
grown a beard, gotten fat, gone off to teach, kind of disappeared.
Yeah, and one could hardly blame him in a sense. And also, he wanted to watch and see how the Bush administration developed. At first, I mean, it's very hard to remember these days, but the Bush administration promised to be kind of semi-isolationist.
Humble in its foreign policy.
Compassionate conservative in its domestic policy and all the rest. Clearly, that hadn't been the case. And Gore, unlike his campaign, began making very clear critiques of Bush having to do with the conduct of the war in Iraq, the invasion itself, abuse of civil liberties, and many other topics. And I got to spend some time with him at a time that really it was kind of a coming out for him.
He had his Mr. Goofy voice, as you described voice. Now he's out with An Inconvenient Truth, as big as
he's got a movie coming
film.
Out now, and he's got having his CNN moment of will he run for president or not, and will we live through another Clinton-Gore psychodrama as we have had in the 90s. But I also got to see how Al Gore lives and what he's like sitting across a table from him the way you and I are now. Mm-hmm. And he's incredibly charming and funny in private, as we've all heard a million times. And then the red light goes on for the television camera and he becomes this different thing. So some of the old habits were in place. And this is just a little taste of this piece called The Wilderness Campaign, mm-hmm. Al Gore. In a little while, we're in Nashville at his very, very nice house. In a little while, a new friend of Gore's, an eccentric musician and visual artist named Robert Ellis Orrell, was going to swing by to take him and Tipper to the Belcourt Theater. "You'll like Bob," Gore said, smiling, "but I'm warning you, he does his own thing. He's kind of a crazy guy." Gore delivered that last sentence in what I came to think of as his Mr. Goofy voice. When he wants to undercut something he is saying to indicate that he knows he is speaking in a cliché or taking on a stentorian or pompous tone, he uses the Mr. Goofy voice, stretching his face into a kind of clownish expression and affecting a tone more suited to a television dinosaur. Then there is the Herr Professor voice, Gore as lecturer. Gore didn't really want to talk politics at first, but when the subject of the press came up, he seized on it and gave, at my best estimation, a 20-minute discourse on the degradation of the public sphere, a phrase coined by the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas in the 1960s. One tries and fails to imagine the current president alluding to the author of Moral Consciousness and Communicative Action. "He's a very interesting guy," Gore said. "Why am I just finding out about him?" So, in other words, Gore is a kind of pedagogue and pedant, and when he realizes he's being a little pedantic, he tries to undercut it with this kind of populist, goofy tone. He's always adjusting himself for the listener, and I think that's part of his charm and also part of why he runs into trouble.
Give us a taste of your other profiles here, the Nabokov detail. I don't know.
Well, Solzhenitsyn, for example. Yeah. I went to see Solzhenitsyn when he was still living not far from here in Cavendish, Vermont.
In a kind of self-imposed exile.
And writing and writing and writing, and he'd been here for years, didn't really know English. But he has this kind of Russian-Americanized crew of kids, really smart young men. And I'd been interviewing Solzhenitsyn all day in his kind of workhouse, which was parallel to the house itself, and we were going to have a big lunch. Mm-hmm. And before going in to lunch, I said to Yermolai, I think was one of the sons, or Stepan, and I said, does your father ever just kind of kick back and become like a normal American guy, or does he always look like this 19th century prophet? Mm. And he said, you know, my dad is my dad, and it's not like he's, you know, decides he wants to watch the Red Sox and have a few brewskis in front of the TV. Mm. He is who he is. And then we sat down at the lunch table, and there we are, and the three guys are talking about college and mm-hmm. Boston and girls and
the young
Saturday
guys,
Night
not
Live.
The great sage.
And then the great sage at the other end of the table was, it was very weird. It's like Tolstoy at lunch.
Yeah.
And he starts going on in Russian about the Chechen War and the perfidy of Yeltsin or whatever it was in this kind of bigger-than-lunch voice.
Yeah.
It's a very strange...
How do we chew our beans?
It's a very, very strange experience to be in his presence, because even in the 20th century, he felt like a 19th century figure.
You write about Solzhenitsyn. You asked the rhetorical question, had he lost his moral authority when he went back home, because you caught up with him again. And you quote a Russian economist, Timofeyev, saying, "In the modern world, moral authorities are proof of a society's inability to live a decent life. To have to rely so much on someone like Solzhenitsyn or Sakharov," someone else who you have profiled, "is a sure sign that something is wrong. Nowadays, I can express myself not by quietly identifying with a figure like this, but by writing, reading, voting, doing business, whatever it is. This is a good thing. Society needs a Solzhenitsyn in a time of emergency, far less so now." What's your sense of society and our moment and the Solzhenitsyn-type figures? You know, there's a lot of talk about democracy and media sort of mm-hmm. freeing up the whole world. And here's Timofeyev saying we can write and read and talk. And do we need those great figures of moral authority?
What he's saying is something different. Mm-hmm. He's not saying that we don't need to think about moral questions. What he's saying is in a totalitarian state, there are so few people, repositories of real moral direction, mm-hmm. and your ability to relate to them has to be surreptitious. It's essentially an active dissident thought or behavior.
Mm-hmm. To hold
in the United States,
icon.
For all its faults, mm-hmm. or Western Europe, or name your country, of course there are such people.
Who do you look to?
Václav Havel is somebody that I admire enormously. In fact, I agree with far more of his politics than Solzhenitsyn.
But in the United States?
Well,
That is my question, whether we have and need such figures now.
Well, look, a lot of people find their moral direction from their priest or their rabbi or the minister, or they might have authors that they find to be particularly wise, whether they're living or dead. Maybe, although not very often, a political figure or someone private. But the need to vest all your hopes and do it in a very private, almost underground way, that's the difference. And you don't want to have your novelists play also the part of the great truth tellers or journalists.
Because it concentrates too much.
Because there's no journalism in a totalitarian mm-hmm. rule. Again, journalism mm-hmm. has all kinds of faults mm-hmm. in this country and others, mm-hmm. but it exists, it struggles, it argues, and all the rest. In the Soviet Union, the person telling you about the history of the camps was not journalism. Pravda couldn't tell that story. Mm-hmm. Izvestia mm-hmm. couldn't tell that story. Mm-hmm. It was a novelist writing books that were not published in that country and you only heard about through surreptitious means. That's what Timofeyev was getting at.
So in your commentary columns today, when your writers step out of their reportorial role and pass judgment on what's going on the war, on an administration, on a cultural trend, is this moral authority? Is this moral guidance?
That's up to the reader.
It's up to the you're
it's
the editor. You're shaping what goes in
yes,
there.
Yes, but
you're
how
you're
it's
inviting
received.
It.
But it's absolutely, and how it's received is up to the reader. And there are many other sources to go to and to have an argument, even on the Iraq War in the beginning, which you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was plenty of pieces before the Iraq War, being very tough on Bush, very tough on the intelligence. The difficulty with the Iraq War was not a question of. No one was voicing X opinion or Y opinion. The problem, certainly for me and for many, many other people, and liberal-minded people as well, is that one of the key pieces of so-called knowledge was not knowledge at all. And that has to do with the WMD question.
We'll look at that. February 03, the New Yorker threw a commentary of yours essentially endorsing the toppling of Saddam Hussein. We'll come to that. But I want to bring our listeners in first, if I may, David Remick. David's calling from Buford.
Let's be fair about what it was. It was saying that Saddam Hussein had behaved in a certain way in the past, and despite all the hypocrisy of American foreign policy in Iraq, that the business of containment was coming to an end, that containment was not working.
We'll come and look at exactly that, at exactly what was said there. Let me bring our listeners in. David's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. What do you think, David?
Well, my simple comment is that I've been reading The New Yorker for a big chunk of my life. I've been reading it for probably over 50 years. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a lot of change, and I'm delighted by that because I found it consistently getting better every year. And I really look forward to the mail on Tuesday when it's delivered because I have something to anticipate for the rest of the week. I don't subscribe to many magazines anymore, but I wanted to congratulate.
I'm delighted to hear it, and I thank you. I really am.
It's a wonderful magazine. I think you used to have a commercial, perhaps the best magazine in the world, somewhere.
Apparently Harrison Salisbury, the great New York Times journalist, somewhere wrote that it was the best magazine in the world, and so I thank him.
Now,
he is gone.
I
met him in Russia, and it was a great honor.
Yeah. I was very much afraid when the new publishers took over. I think it's Newhouse.
Mm-hmm. In the 80s.
Their previous track record. But I'm delighted they've apparently kept hands off and let the New Yorker grow the way it has. And you're doing a superb job, David. And
thank
I
you.
Congratulate you.
Thank you very
David,
much.
That's terrific. There's a big thumbs up, and thanks for calling in with it from Buford. Let's get a call from Clear Lake, Iowa. Susan's on the line. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
I'm like your previous reader. I've been reading the magazine since the 1950s, and it seems to me that the current pop culture is more prevalent than it was earlier. And
in the pages of the New Yorker,
yes.
more prevalent than under Tina Brown, who
famously brought her celebrity instinct. No. I would have to agree that was at a time that's probably where this pop culture information began to be published, including the ads and the color photographs and things. I'm not saying that I would like you to go back to the style of the 50s, but, for instance, I greatly appreciated Dana Goodyear's American Chronicles in the, I think it was the April 24th issue, about what happened at Alder Creek and the Donner family party. But in that same issue, I was curious that Sister Ping's people smuggling enterprise was felt important enough to report on, and I'm just wondering who the audience is for that type of information.
Well, if I could answer that question, in all due respect, and I appreciate your staying with the magazine and liking what you like and being critical of what you're being critical, but Sister Ping was smuggling people into the United States. It was an immigration piece, and I'm not quite sure why. Well, it certainly was an immigration piece, and a lot of people either died or were injured when the Golden Venture washed up on the shores of New York.
This is the boat full of illegal immigrants, Chinese, that the founder had such trouble.
To be honest with you, I think
that's a great piece of reporting.
Excellent piece of reporting. And on the pop culture question, popular culture is important. I mean, the only indigenous art form that the United States has is jazz music. What is jazz music? Jazz music came out of blues and ragtime, and it's a popular culture form, risen to art. These things are very important to the people that they're important to. Television reaches hundreds of millions of people, and so it's up to our critics to say what's good, what's bad, what's interesting, what's dull. And I'd say the same thing about radio or sports or...
Right, well, I'm certainly...
I mean, here we are on the radio. Is that necessarily high culture? To me, there's music, and there's Beethoven, and there's hip hop, and there's all kinds of stuff. I'm a big defender of popular culture, and I'm not even sure it needs my defense.
Susan, you're hanging in there with that?
Yeah, actually, I do greatly find important the current reviews of the culture.
Good.
Was curious about the. For instance, the Sister Ping piece, and I can understand now as you explain it to me that you felt it was an immigration piece, that it certainly was.
Well, give it a try. Maybe you'll like it better the second time around.
Thank you very much, please,
understand that we understand that you're not going to like everything.
Sure.
It's like a restaurant that and you're not going to love everything on the menu, but we just hope you keep showing up.
Susan in Clear Lake, Iowa, thanks very much for joining us. David Ehrmich, what about it? New Yorker, timeless or changing, the sort of mix of celebrity, news orientation, which you've brought forcefully to the magazine, reporting for the ages, the kind of John McPhee material that used to be there. How do you see the New Yorker in its evolutionary arc these days?
Well, we live in a different world, don't we? And when the magazine began in 1925, sorry for the kind of historical breadth of this, but it was a magazine of the Manhattan high life. All the pieces were tiny, very small. The first profile was a page long.
Eustace Tilley in the Monocle, kind of.
Yeah, and the times have changed the New Yorker, and it grew up in the Second World War. The whole business of serious reporting, which we now take for granted as part and parcel of the New Yorker, that's a Second World War add-on for the New Yorker. Serious fiction was not there from the beginning. When you say celebrity, the New Yorker has always written about celebrity. One of its most famous profiles in the early days was of Henry Luce. Was he a celebrity? Yes. Janet Flanner didn't just write about Hitler. She wrote about dress designers like Schiaparelli. So, there's a kind of faux snobism that comes with the New Yorker that I'm against, and I'm with Tina Brown on that question. We may differ on many things, and I'm certainly going to differ with any editor. I am myself, and I'm not William Shawn or Tina Brown or Harold Ross. I wish I were in some ways, but the notion that we should avoid all subjects that smack of either pop culture or celebrity, I'm against. What I am for is avoiding celebrity on its own terms. In other words, doing a piece simply because somebody's famous or has a book out or a movie out, if they won't give us the access to do a good story on its own terms, forget it. We should walk away.
David Ehrmich, editor-in-chief of the New Yorker magazine, is with us. He's out with a new collection of profiles that are certainly not just celebrity puff pieces. They go deep on everybody from Al Gore to Solzhenitsyn to Don DeLillo. Benjamin Netanyahu, you name it. You can join our conversation. What do you think? In an age of blogs and print media, whoa, look at those newspaper circulation figures. Will this kind of publication last? What do you hear in the editing? What do you read in the editing of David Remnick? We're at 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with David Remnick. He's editor-in-chief of The New Yorker magazine. He's an editor-in-chief who gets out and about. He's out with a new collection of profiles, reporting, writings from The New Yorker, profiles of everybody from Don DeLillo and Vaclav Havel to, you name it, Mike Tyson and Amos Oz and Vladimir Putin, Katherine Graham, Natan Sharansky. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I'd like to bring the conversation back to the to Iraq and supporting the toppling of Saddam Hussein. I've grown frustrated listening to pundits and journalists who have said that they supported the toppling of Saddam Hussein, but now are having second thoughts because of the execution of the war, et cetera. My question is, if the goal was to topple Saddam Hussein, what's the difference between toppling a dictator like Hussein and assassinating a leader like Pinochet? And if they are, as I assume, similar in some respects, aren't they equally detestable and therefore on some level, immoral?
Mark, let me ask you first. I mean, everybody can have their opinion, but I think just at a simple level, a lot more people would say Saddam Hussein is a bad guy.
And Pinochet was an elected head of state of Chile, and Chile, so far as I know, posed no... there was never any whisper of military threat of Chile against anybody. So,
but Mark, your question is it ever justified to go in and topple a head of state, period?
Well, look, can I address the question a little bit? And I understand your frustration. I don't know how old you are. I'm in my mid-40s. I'm not a Vietnam child alone. I'm also a child of, as it were, of Bosnia and Kosovo and our unbelievable reluctance in Rwanda. So... to me, the issue of the use of military force abroad is a really vexed one because, to my mind, the use of military force in the Balkans came to a good result, and we waited way too long until many, many people were killed. And in Rwanda, our reluctance, and I mean by our, I mean the entire West and the UN and et cetera, led to a genocide, something that we could have improved immeasurably with at least some military presence there. Not everything. And now we're in a situation in Darfur where everybody's being reluctant and the African Union is unable to stop it and the UN is much too timid.
But Iraq is none of those situations.
Well, the problem with Iraq is there was no... First of all, a lot of people opposed the first Iraq war on the basis of it's an internal affair of Iraq and so on. And by the way, the magazine before I got there was against the first Iraq war.
But you wrote, and let me try and cut to the chase. You wrote in February 2003, all our listeners may not. History will not easily excuse us if by deciding not to decide, we defer a reckoning with an aggressive totalitarian leader who intends not only to develop weapons of mass destruction, but also to use them.
Which was wrong about WMD. The great tragedy is that we were absolutely wrong. And I think part of the reason we've been so tough on the Bush administration since is their handling and manipulation of intelligence about WMD.
That's one thing that you and a lot of people were wrong about. Another thing is the prosecution of the war itself. I mean, let me put to you the same question I put to Tom Friedman, New York Times columnist, and of course he had a similar stance on the war. I mean, if you recommend surgery by a surgeon who can't wield the tools well, then are you right to recommend surgery in the first place? I mean,
essentially is if you can't trust the Bush administration to do anything, should you endorse their doing any kind of action whatsoever?
This isn't just any kind of action. This is war. I mean, you've got on the cover this week Uncle Sam as an empty suit. Your columns week after week pummel the administration, you know, on Abu Ghraib, Seymour Hirsch, or, you know, right on down the line.
I take your point.
Did you misjudge the capacity of those who are wielding the power to do?
Well, of course. I don't think anybody anticipated, even on the left, the extraordinary incompetence and fecklessness of the administration. Maybe some did, and if they did, all the power to them.
There it is. Mark, thanks very much for your call. Tim's calling from West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Tim, you're on the air.
Hello. Honored to be speaking with you. I happen to be lucky enough to be in Prague between Christmas and New Year's, 1989.
Me too.
And, I mean, the only experience in my life that it remotely compares to is when the Red Sox won the World Series.
Some amazing time, the Velvet Revolution, it all coming down there.
As a New Yorker, I have to dissent on this.
Oh, yes, of course. Excuse us.
Okay. Like on New Year's Eve, you know, I was walking down Wenceslas Square, and, you know, people would say hello to me. I'd say hello. They'd recognize me as an American by my voice and, you know, drink this.
It was like a fairy tale. I mean, it was just extraordinary. My wife and I were there.
And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what Mr. Havels had to say about, you know, the mood of the population in Prague during those times.
You write about Havel as he was completing his time in power, the other end of that story.
I think the life of Václav Havel is like the other side of the mirror of Kafka. I mean, look at who he was and who he is. Here's a guy who grew up as a bourgeois Czech. Suddenly there's this communist revolution. He lives the war as a child, and then he lives through this revolution, and the situation in Prague and Czechoslovakia gets worse and worse and more repressive. They live through the false promise of 1968. And he's a dissident playwright and a kind of moral authority of the kind of which we were talking before, a very, very rare cat indeed. And in the space of 2 weeks, he goes from becoming a formerly jailed dissident playwright to the president. And where is he elevated to? To the castle.
The castle.
And so suddenly the guy who was the dissident drinking beer in cafes and avoiding, if he could, imprisonment is hosting the Rolling Stones and Bill Clinton.
Toast to the world.
He was the toast to the world. And then suddenly has a country to run.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly it shifts from poetry to prose, the poetry of the revolution to the prose of ruling. And what this piece is about is essentially his thoughts on his way out. And by the way, to show that far more than journalists, but moral authorities are fallible, Havel as well was, like me and like many others, reluctantly for the use of military force against Saddam Hussein, and like a lot of us, would have preferred a much greater international alliance in this and all the rest, but it was on the basis of WMD information that was clearly both wrong and manipulated.
Tim, thanks for bringing that Czech moment back to us. Zvi is calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Zvi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
A couple of questions, and both part of the same general category. I was very curious and disappointed when Art Spiegelman departed The New Yorker.
The great cartoonist.
He didn't depart. He's published with us quite recently during the Danish cartoon.
I know, but I was talking about that separation.
Art has gone back, and he's left and come back to the magazine I don't know how many times during Tina's time when
he
started.
But what did happen?
Well.
What are we talking about?
Nothing.
Here, the incident?
Yeah, he went and he published elsewhere. And
because?
Ask Art.
Because he's Art Spiegelman. Zvi, what's your understanding, Zvi?
My understanding is that there was a disagreement over the support of the New Yorker for the war at the time. And my, I guess I wouldn't have made the call mm-hmm. had I not heard Mr. Remnick say mm-hmm. that everybody was sort of convinced about the WMD at that time.
No, can I interrupt for 1 second? Art Spiegelman's wife, whose politics are identical to Art, is our cover editor and has been.
Let me just finish my point.
And has finished.
I admire almost everything. I've been a supporter and a subscriber and remain
right.
one.
Right.
It was just on that particular area, but the.
But I don't want you to be mistaken in the notion that we had no pieces that were at either critical of or anti-war. This was a debate within the magazine. Rick Hertzberg certainly published comment pieces.
Many.
Completely reluctant about the war in the run-up to it. So the notion that somehow there was a monolithic feeling about the war, I think this is totally mistaken.
See, let me just ask you as a reader, you've seen all the tough pieces more recently in The New Yorker. Do you see The New Yorker now on a political crusade against the war, against the Bush administration, or not? How do you read it?
I think it has now what I would term a much more critical and open-eyed attitude toward the war. The one piece of information that I was fascinated that the American press universally ignored here in Canada, not far from Toronto. Mm. Is living the guy who was in charge of the nuclear or the approach to the development of the nuclear program, the nuclear weapons program mm-hmm. for Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. He was interviewed on a program here called The Current on CBC. This was before the war began. It was a long interview. It was fascinating. I tried calling several places in the States. New York wasn't one of them. To let people know about this and get
so you would have gone the other way on the basis of what you heard.
In fairness, we never ever believed the nuclear component of this. But remember this, and look at Foreign Affairs magazine recently. Part of the difficulty of this was that unlike Iran, which is trying to cover up its nuclear program and denying in every which way it can that it's at all military, Iraq is quite the opposite in 1990 through 93.
Suggesting
it's
all
trying
kinds of
to
things.
Project to the mm-hmm. world as much as possible mm-hmm. that it has all these things, and all the while had been denuded of it. That's part of the one of the most difficult things to reckon with, and that Saddam Hussein's was kind of crazy in this way, and in order to project strength, he wanted to project to his own people as well as to the region that he had chemical and biological weapons.
David Remnick, our time grows short. We've just got a minute here. And Zvi, thanks for your call. Is The New Yorker now in a compensatory mode on this? Or how do you see the political face of the man? It's very, very tough.
No.
And why not? There's plenty to be critical of. I guess I should put it this way. Is The New Yorker now a political magazine in a way that it had not been before?
Well, I think during Watergate and during the Vietnam War, the comment pieces that were being published by Jonathan Schell mm-hmm. and edited by William Shawn, and they worked very closely together on those, were extremely firm and stand up. And I think in other instances, The New Yorker has had a political, shall we say, a stance. But I don't want The New Yorker to become The Nation or The New Republic, or The Weekly Standard. We're not an opinion magazine. What's at the real center of the magazine, besides the literary aspect of it, is reporting. And for me, reporting is not a political act, except insofar as it tries to tell the truth in a given period of time, insofar as we know it.
Mm. David Remnick makes it very detailed and up close. I'm sorry we didn't get to Mike Tyson, that moment where you've got him going into Holyfield's sweaty neck almost tenderly, purposefully, as if he were snuffling for truffles to bite another ear. It's a great collection of profiles. We're grateful for your time with us. It's great to have you, David Remnick. Thanks so much for having me. Editor-in-chief of The New Yorker magazine, David Remnick. His new book is Reporting, Writings from The New Yorker. In a moment, Colin Powell congratulates the class of 2006. This is On Point. It is commencement season, and we've been bringing you notable speeches from graduation ceremonies around the country. Former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State Colin Powell recently addressed graduating seniors at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. As he congratulated the students and their families, he reminisced about his own undergraduate years at City College of New York in Harlem.
I graduated from CCNY back in 1958. It's a great school in Harlem. It's known as the Harvard of the poor. It takes in immigrant kids and educates them. It took me in. I wasn't one of their leading students. It took me 4.5 years, 2 changes of major, and straight A's and ROTC for 4 years to raise my average up to a C so that I could graduate. And when I finally did graduate after those 4.5 years, the faculty was enormously relieved. And they were content for me to go in the Army, let the Army worry about him, just be gone. Now, of course, I am considered one of the greatest sons of CCNY. I have been given an honorary degree from there. I go to every fundraising dinner they can think of inviting me to. But the funny thing about it is that there was no way to predict any of this. What happened to me in college was that I found what I was good at, and I found what I loved doing, and that was soldiering. And although over the years, as you have heard, I have done many different things, to include diplomacy, business, working with children, I'm still what I was and what I have always wanted to be and loved being, and that was a soldier. Some of you in the graduating class may know now already what it is you want to do with the rest of your life. You may know now what you love doing and what you do well, and you're prepared to commit yourselves to it. But many of you may not know yet. You may still be looking, and you may go down several false trails along the way. But never stop looking until you find that one thing which you love doing and which you do well. You just can't tell where the future will take you, but it will take you somewhere. I get asked all the time in the most interesting way, well, General Powell, when you were a young boy growing up in the Bronx, did you dream that you would become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State of the United States of America? I always kind of smile and answer, yeah, there I was. I believe I was about 9 years old, standing at the corner of 163rd Street in Kelly. And I said to myself, self, I believe you're going to grow up and become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State of the United States of America. You don't know. The one thing you do know is that you've been prepared at this wonderful university for whatever is awaiting you there. You are grounded with a solid education. You are grounded with an understanding of the need for character and competence. You are grounded in your faith, and you're prepared for whatever road opens to you.
Former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State Colin Powell addressing the graduating class at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, and Christina Russo, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Cozzelli, all ably led this week by Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.